The golden battle barges of Imria are ready to defend their city, my liege. It will take time, however, to maneuver them into position. It is doubtful if all will fit into the maze at once.
Then sail some of them out now and hide them around the coast, so that they can wait for any survivors that may escape our attack, Elric instructed him.
A useful plan, my liege.
Makum Kolim bowed and sank back into the crowd of his peers. The debate continued for some time, and then they were ready and about to leave. But then Prince Irkun bellowed once more.
I repeat my offer to the Emperor. His person is too valuable to risk in battle. My person, it is worthless. Let me command the warriors of both land and sea, while the Emperor may remain at the palace, untroubled by the battle, confident that it will be won and the Southlanders trounced. Perhaps there is a book he wishes to finish.
Elric smiled. Again, I thank you for your concern, Prince Irkun, but an emperor must exercise his body as well as his mind. I will command the warriors tomorrow. When Elric arrived back at his apartments, it was to discover that Tanglebones had already laid out his heavy black war gear. Here was the armor which had served 100 Melnibonean emperors, an armor which was forged by sorcery to give it a strength unequaled on the realm of Earth, which could, so rumor went, even withstand the bite of the mythical rune blades, Stormbringer and Mornblade, which had been wielded by the wickedest of Melnibone's many wicked rulers, before being seized by the lords of the higher worlds and hidden forever in a realm where even those lords might rarely venture. The face of the tangled man was full of joy as he touched each piece of armor, each finely balanced weapon, with his long, gnarled fingers. His seamed face looked up to regard Elric's care-ravaged features.
Oh, my lord! Oh, my king! Soon you will know the joy of the fight!
Aye, Tanglebones. And let us hope it will be a joy.
I taught you all the skills, the art of the sword and the poniard, the art of the bow, the art of the spear, both mounted and on foot, and you learned well, for they all say you are weak. Save one, there's no better swordsman in Melnibone.
Prince Irkun could be better than me, Elric said reflectively.
Could he not? I said, save one, my lord.
And Irkun is that one. Well, one day perhaps we'll be able to test the matter. I'll bathe before I don all that metal.
Best make speed, master. From what I hear, there is much to do.
And I'll sleep after I've bathed. Elric smiled at his old friend's consternation. It will be better thus, for I cannot personally direct the barges into position. I am needed to command the fray, and that I will do better when I've rested.
If you think it good, Lord King, then it is good.
And you are astonished. You are too eager, Tanglebones, to get me into all that stuff and see me strut about in it as if I were Arioch himself. Tanglebones' hands flew to his mouth, as if he had spoken the words, not his master, and he was trying to block them. His eyes widened. Elric laughed. You think I speak bold heresies, eh? Well, I've spoken worse without any ill befalling me. On Melnibone, Tanglebones, the emperors control the demons, not the reverse.
So you say, my liege.
It is the truth. Elric swept from the room, calling for his slaves. The war fever filled him, and he was jubilant. Now he was all in his black gear, the massive breastplate, the padded jerkin, the long greaves, the mail gauntlets. At his side was a 5-foot broadsword, which, it was said, had belonged to a human hero called Aubek. Resting on the deck against the golden rail of the bridge was the great round war board, his shield, bearing the sign of the swooping dragon. And a helm was on his head, a black helm, with a dragon's head craning over the peak, and dragon's wings flaring backward above it, and a dragon's tail curling down the back. All the helm was black, but within the helm there was a white shadow, from which glared 2 crimson orbs, and from the sides of the helm strayed wisps of milk-white hair, almost like smoke escaping from a burning building. And as the helm turned, in what little light came from the lantern hanging at the base of the mainmast, the white shadow sharpened to reveal features, fine, handsome features, a straight nose, curved lips, upslanting eyes. The face of Emperor Elric of Melnibone peered into the gloom of the maze as he listened for the first sounds of the Sea Raiders' approach. He stood on the high bridge of the great golden battle barge, which, like all its kind, resembled a floating ziggurat equipped with masts and sails and oars and catapults. The ship was called the Son of the Piare, and it was the flagship of the fleet. The Grand Admiral, Makum Kolim, stood beside Elric. Like Divim Tvar, the Admiral was one of Elric's few close friends. He had known Elric all his life, and had encouraged him to learn all he could concerning the running of fighting ships and fighting fleets. Privately, Makum Kolim might fear that Elric was too scholarly and introspective to rule Melnibone, but he accepted Elric's right to rule, and was made angry and impatient by the talk of the likes of Irkun. Prince Irkun was also aboard the flagship, though at this moment he was below, inspecting the war engines. The Son of the Piare lay at anchor in a huge grotto, one of hundreds built into the walls of the maze when the maze itself was built, and designed for just this purpose, to hide a battle barge. There was just enough height for the masts, and enough width for the oars to move freely. Each of the golden battle barges was equipped with banks of oars, each bank containing between 20 and 30 oars on either side. The banks were 4, 5, or 6 decks high, and, as in the case of the Son of Piare, might have 3 independent steering systems, fore and aft. Being armored all in gold, the ships were virtually indestructible, and, for all their massive size, they could move swiftly and maneuver delicately when occasion demanded. It was not the first time they'd waited for their enemies in these grottos. It would not be the last, though when next they waited, it would be in greatly different circumstances. The battle barges of Melnibone were rarely seen on the open seas these days, but once they had sailed the oceans of the world like fearsome floating mountains of gold, and they had brought terror whenever they were sighted. The fleet had been larger then, comprising hundreds of craft. Now there were less than 40 ships, but 40 would suffice. Now, in damp darkness, they awaited their enemies. Listening to the hollow slap of the water against the sides of the ship, Elric wished that he'd been able to conceive a better plan than this. He was sure that this one would work, but he regretted the waste of lives, both Melnibonean and barbarian. It would have been better if some way could have been devised of frightening the barbarians away rather than trapping them in the sea maze. The Southlander fleet was not the first to have been attracted by Imrir's fabulous wealth. The Southlander crews were not the first to entertain the belief that the Melnibonaeans, because they never now ventured far from the Dreaming City, had become decadent and unable to defend their treasures. And so the Southlanders must be destroyed in order to make the lesson clear. Melnibone was still strong. She was strong enough, in Irkun's view, to resume her former dominance of the world, strong in sorcery, if not in soldiery.
"Hist!" Admiral Makum Kolim craned forward. "Was that the sound of an oar?"
Elric nodded. I think so. Now they heard regular splashes, as rows of oars dipping in and out of the water, and they heard the creak of timbers. The Southlanders were coming. The son of the PRA was the ship nearest to the entrance, and it would be the first to move out, but only when the last of the Southlanders' ships had passed them. Admiral Makum Kolim bent and extinguished the lantern. Then quickly, quietly, he descended to inform his crew of the raiders' coming. Not long before, Irkun had used his sorcery to summon a peculiar mist, which hid the golden barges from view, but through which those on the Melnibonean ships could peer. Now Elric saw torches burning in the channel ahead, as carefully the reavers negotiated the maze. Within the space of a few minutes, 10 of the galleys had passed the grotto. Admiral Makum Kolim rejoined Elric on the bridge, and now Prince Irkun was with him. Irkun, too, wore a dragon helm, though less magnificent than Elric's, for Elric was chief of the few surviving dragon princes of Melnibone. Irkun was grinning through the gloom, and his eyes gleamed in anticipation of the bloodletting to come. Elric wished that Prince Irkun had chosen another ship than his, but it was Irkun's right to be aboard the flagship, and he could not deny it. Now half the 100 vessels had gone past. Irkun's armor creaked as impatiently he waited, pacing the bridge, his gauntleted hand on the hilt of his broadsword. Soon, he kept saying to himself. Soon. And then their anchor was groaning upwards, and their oars were plunging into the water as the last Southland ship went by, and they shot from the grotto into the channel, ramming the enemy galley amidships and smashing it in two. A great yell went up from the barbarian crew. Men were flung in all directions. Torches danced erratically on the remains of the deck as men tried to save themselves from slipping into the dark, chill waters of the channel. A few brave spears rattled against the sides of the Melnibonean flag galley as it began to turn among the debris it had created. But Imrerian archers returned the shots, and the few survivors went down. The sound of this swift conflict was the signal to the other battle barges. In perfect order they came from both sides of the high rock walls, and it must have seemed to the astonished barbarians that the great golden ships had actually emerged from solid stone, ghost ships filled with demons who rained spears, arrows, and brands upon them. Now the whole of the twisting channel was confusion, and a medley of war shouts echoed and boomed, and the clash of steel upon steel was like the savage hissing of some monstrous snake. And the raiding fleet itself resembled a snake, which had been broken into 100 pieces by the tall, implacable golden ships of Melnibone. These ships seemed almost serene as they moved among their enemies, their grappling irons flashing out to catch wooden decks and rails and draw the galleys nearer so they might be destroyed. But the Southlanders were brave, and they kept their heads after their initial astonishment. Three of the galleys headed directly for the son of the PRA, recognizing it as the flagship. Fire arrows sailed high and dropped down onto the decks, which were wooden and not protected by the golden armor, starting fires wherever they fell, or else bringing blazing death to the men they struck. Elric raised his shield above his head, and two arrows struck it, bouncing, still flaring, to a lower deck. He leapt over the rail, following the arrows, jumping down to the widest and most exposed deck, where his warriors were grouping, ready to deal with the attacking galleys. Catapults thudded, and balls of blue fire swished through the blackness, narrowly missing all three galleys. Another volley followed, and one mass of flame struck the far galley's mast and then burst upon the deck, scattering huge flames wherever it touched. Grapples snaked out and seized the first galley, dragging it close, and Elric was among the first to leap down onto the deck, rushing forward to where he saw the Southland captain, dressed all in crude, checkered armor, a checkered surcoat over that, a big sword in both his huge hands, bellowing at his men to resist the Melnibonean dogs. As Elric approached the bridge, three barbarians armed with curved swords and small oblong shields ran at him. Their faces were full of fear, but there was determination there as well, as if they knew they must die, but planned to wreak as much destruction as they could before their souls were taken. Shifting his warboard onto his arm, Elric took his own broadsword in both hands and charged the sailors, knocking one off his feet with the lip of the shield and smashing the collarbone of another. The remaining barbarian skipped aside and thrust his curved sword at Elric's face. Elric barely escaped the thrust, and the sharp edge of the sword grazed his cheek, bringing out a drop or two of blood. Elric swung the broadsword like a scythe, and it bit deep into the barbarian's waist, almost cutting him in two. He struggled for a moment, unable to believe that he was dead, but then, as Elric yanked the sword free, he closed his eyes and dropped. The man who had been struck by Elric's shield was staggering to his feet as Elric whirled, saw him, and smashed the broadsword into his skull. Now the way to the bridge was clear. Elric began to climb the ladder, noting that the captain had seen him and was waiting for him at the top. Elric raised his shield to take the captain's first blow. Through all the noise, he thought he heard the man shouting at him, "Die, you white-faced demon, die! You have no place in this earth any longer!" Elric was almost diverted from defending himself by these words. They rang true to him. Perhaps he really had no place on earth. Perhaps that was why Melniboné was slowly collapsing, why fewer children were born every year, why the dragons themselves were no longer breeding. He let the captain strike another blow at the shield, then he reached under it and swung at the man's legs. But the captain had anticipated the move and jumped backwards. This, however, gave Elric time to run up the few remaining steps and stand on the deck, facing the captain. The man's face was almost as pale as Elric's. He was sweating, and he was panting, and his eyes had misery in them as well as wild fear. "You should leave us alone," Elric heard himself saying. "We offer you no harm, barbarian. When did Melniboné last sail against the young kingdoms? You offer us harm by your very presence, white face. There is your sorcery, there are your customs, and there is your arrogance. Is that why you came here? Was your attack motivated by disgust for us? Or would you help yourselves to our wealth? Admit it, captain. Greed brought you to Melniboné. At least greed is an honest quality, an understandable one, but you creatures are not human. Worse, you're not gods, though you behave as if you were. Your day is over, and you must be wiped out, your city destroyed, your sorceries forgotten." Elric nodded. "Perhaps you were right, captain." "I am right. Our holy men say so. Our seers predict your downfall. The Chaos Lords whom you serve will themselves bring about that downfall." "The Chaos Lords no longer have any interest in the affairs of Melniboné. They took away their power nearly 1,000 years since." Elric watched the captain carefully, judging the distance between them. "Perhaps that is why our own power waned. Or perhaps we merely became tired of power." "Be that as it may," the captain said, wiping his sweating brow, "your time is over. You must be destroyed once and for all." And then he groaned, for Elric's broadsword had come under his checkered breastplate and gone up through his stomach and into his lungs. One knee bent, one leg stretched behind him, Elric began to withdraw the long sword, looking up into the barbarian's face, which had now assumed an expression of reconciliation. "That was unfair, Whiteface. We had barely begun to talk, and you cut the conversation short. You are most skillful. May you writhe forever in the higher hell. Farewell." Elric hardly knew why, after the captain had fallen face down on the deck, he hacked twice at the neck until the head rolled off the body, rolled to the side of the bridge, and then was kicked over the side so that it sank into the cold, deep water. And then Yerkoon came up behind Elric, and he was grinning. "You fight fiercely and well, my lord, emperor. That dead man was right." "Right?" Elric glared at his cousin. "Right? Aye, in his assessment of your prowess." And chuckling, Yerkoon went to supervise his men who were finishing off the few remaining raiders. Elric did not know why he had refused to hate Yerkoon before, but now He did hate Irkun. At that moment, he would gladly have slain him. It was as if Irkun had looked deeply into Elric's soul and expressed contempt for what he had seen there. Suddenly, Elric was overwhelmed by an angry misery, and he wished with all his heart that he was not a Melnibonean, that he was not an emperor, and that Irkun had never been born. Like haughty leviathans, the great golden battle barges swam through the wreckage of the Reaver fleet. A few ships burned and a few were still sinking, but most had sunk into the unplumbable depths of the channel. The burning ships sent strange shadows dancing against the dank walls of the sea caverns, as if the ghosts of the slain offered a last salute before departing to the sea depths, where, it was said, a Chaos King still ruled, crewing his eerie fleets with the souls of all who died in conflict upon the oceans of the world. Or perhaps they went to a gentler doom, serving Strasha, Lord of the Water Elementals, who ruled the upper reaches of the sea. But a few had escaped. Somehow the Southland sailors had got past the massive battle barges, sailed back through the channel, and must even now have reached the open sea. This was reported to the flagship, where Elric, Makum Kolim, and Prince Irkun now stood together again on the bridge, surveying the destruction they had wreaked. "Then we must pursue them and finish them," said Irkun. He was sweating and his dark face glistened. His eyes were alight with fever. "We must follow them." Elric shrugged. He was weak. He had brought no extra drugs with him to replenish his strength. He wished to go back to Ymir and rest. He was tired of bloodletting, tired of Irkun, and tired most of all of himself. The hatred he felt for his cousin was draining him still further, and he hated the hatred. That was the worst part. "No," he said. "Let them go.
Let them go! Unpunished! Come now, my lord king, that is not our way!"
Prince Irkun turned to the aging admiral.
"Is that our way, Admiral Makum Kolim?"
Makum Kolim shrugged. He too was tired, but privately he agreed with Prince Irkun. An enemy of Melnibone should be punished for daring to even think of attacking the Dreaming City. Yet he said,
"The Emperor must decide."
"Let them go," said Elric again. He leant heavily against the rail.
"Let them carry the news back to their own barbarian land. Let them say how the dragon princes defeated them. The news will spread. I believe we shall not be troubled by raiders again for some time." "The young kingdoms are full of fools," Irkun replied. "They will not believe the news. There will always be raiders. The best way to warn them will be to make sure that not one Southlander remains alive or uncaptured."
Elric drew a deep breath and tried to fight the faintness which threatened to overwhelm him.
"Prince Irkun, you are trying my patience." "But my emperor, I think only of the good of Melnibone. Surely you do not want your people to say that you are weak, that you fear a fight with but 5 Southland galleys?"
This time Elric's anger brought him strength.
"Who will say that Elric is weak? Will it be you, Irkun?"
He knew that his next statement was senseless, but there was nothing he could do to stop it.
"Very well. Let us pursue these poor little boats and sink them. And let us make haste. I am weary of it all."
There was a mysterious light in Irkun's eyes as he turned away to relay the orders. The sky was turning from black to gray when the Melnibonean fleet reached the open sea and turned its prows south towards the Boiling Sea and the southern continent beyond. The barbarian ships would not sail through the Boiling Sea. No mortal ship could do that, it was said, but would sail around it. Not that the barbarian ships would even reach the edges of the Boiling Sea, for the huge battle barges were fast-sailing vessels. The slaves who pulled the oars were full of a drug which increased their speed and their strength for a score or so of hours before it slew them. And now the sails billowed out, catching the breeze. Golden mountains skimming rapidly over the sea, these ships. Their method of construction was a secret lost even to the Melnibonians, who had forgotten so much of their lore. It was easy to imagine how men of the young kingdoms hated Melnibone and its inventions, for it did seem that the battle barges belonged to an older, alien age, as they bore down upon the fleeing galleys now sighted on the horizon. The son of the PRA was in the lead of the rest of the fleet, and was priming its catapults well before any of its fellows had seen the enemy. Perspiring slaves gingerly manhandled the viscous stuff of the fireballs, getting them into the bronze cups of the catapults by means of long, spoon-ended tongs. It flickered in the pre-dawn gloom. Now slaves climbed the steps to the bridge and brought wine and food on platinum platters for the three dragon princes who had remained there since the pursuit had begun. Elric could not summon the strength to eat, but he seized a tall cup of yellow wine and drained it. The stuff was strong and revived him a trifle. He had another cup poured and drank that as swiftly as the other. He peered ahead. It was almost dawn. There was a line of purple light on the horizon. "At the first sign of the sun's disk," Elric said, "let loose the fireballs."
"I will give the order," said Makum Kolim, wiping his lips and putting down the meat bone on which he'd been chewing.
He left the bridge. Elric heard his feet striking the steps heavily. All at once the albino felt surrounded by enemies. There had been something strange in Makum Kolim's manner during the argument with Prince Irkun. Elric tried to shake off such foolish thoughts, but the weariness, the self-doubt, the open mockery of his cousin all succeeded in increasing the feeling that he was alone and without friends in the world. Even Simril and Divim Tvar were, finally, Melnibonians, and could not understand the peculiar concerns which moved him and dictated his actions. Perhaps it would be wise to renounce everything Melnibonian and wander the world as an anonymous soldier of fortune, serving whoever needed his aid. The dull red semicircle of the sun showed above the black line of the distant water. There came a series of booming sounds from the forward decks of the flagship as the catapults released their fiery shot. There was a whistling scream fading away, and it seemed that a dozen meteors leapt through the sky, hurtling towards the five galleys which were now little more than 30 ship lengths away. Elric saw two galleys flare, but the remaining three began to sail a zigzag course and avoided the fireballs which landed on the water and burned fitfully for a while before sinking, still burning, into the depths. More fireballs were prepared, and Elric heard Irkun shout from the other side of the bridge, ordering the slaves to greater exertions. Then the fleeing vessels changed their tactics, evidently realizing they could not save themselves for long, and, spreading out, sailed towards the son of the PRA, just as the other ships had done in the sea maze. It was not merely their courage that Elric admired, but their maneuvering skill and the speed at which they'd arrived at this logical, if hopeless, decision. The sun was behind the Southland ships as they turned. Three brave silhouettes drew nearer to the Melnibonean flagship as scarlet stained the sea, as if in anticipation of the bloodletting to come. Another volley of fireballs was flung from the flagship, and the leading galley tried to tack round and avoid it, but two of the fiery globes splattered directly on its deck, and soon the whole ship was alive with flame. Burning men leapt into the water. Burning men shot arrows at the flagship. Burning men slowly fell from their positions in the rigging. The burning men died, but the burning ship came on. Someone had lashed the steering arm and directed the galley at the son of PRA. It crashed into the golden side of the battle barge, and some of the fire splashed on the deck where the main catapults were in position. A cauldron containing the fire stuff caught, and immediately men were running from all quarters of the ship to try and douse the flame. Elric grinned as he saw what the barbarians had done. Perhaps that ship had deliberately allowed itself to be fired. Now the majority of the flagship's complement was engaged with putting out the blaze, while the Southland ships drew alongside, threw up their own grapples, and began to board.
"Ware boarders!" Elric shouted long after he might have warned his crew. "Barbarians attack!"
He saw Irkun whirl round, see the situation, and rush down the steps from the bridge.
"You stay there, my lord king," he flung at Elric as he disappeared. "You are plainly too weary to fight."
And Elric summoned all that was left of his strength and stumbled after his cousin to help in the defense of the ship. The barbarians were not fighting for their lives. They knew those to be taken already. They were fighting for their pride. They wanted to take one Melnibonean ship down with them, and that ship must be the flagship itself. It was hard to be contemptuous of such men. They knew that even if they took the flagship, the other ships of the Golden Fleet would soon overwhelm them. But the other ships were still some distance away. Many lives would be lost before they reached the flagship. On the lowest deck, Elric found himself facing a pair of tall barbarians, each armed with a curved blade and a small oblong shield. He lunged forward, but his armor seemed to drag at his limbs. His own shield and sword were so heavy he could barely lift them. Two swords struck at his helm almost simultaneously. He lunged back and caught a man in the arm, rammed the other with his shield. A curved blade clanged on his backplate, and he all but lost his footing. There was choking smoke everywhere and heat and the tumult of battle. Desperately, he swung about him and felt his broadsword bite deep into flesh. One of his opponents fell, gurgling with blood spouting from his mouth and nose. The other lunged. Elric stepped backwards, fell over the corpse of the man he had slain, and went down, his broadsword held out before him in one hand. And as the triumphant barbarian leapt forward to finish the albino, Elric caught him on the point of the broadsword, running him through. The dead man fell towards Elric, who did not feel the impact, for he had already fainted. Not for the first time had his deficient blood, no longer enriched by drugs, betrayed him.